We will resume our study in Zechariah chapter 13. Zechariah 13. And again, to understand Zechariah, and Zechariah has a lot of eschatology, that is, what's going to happen in the future, it's critical that you understand the concept of dispensations. Dispensational theology is something that's lost in many circles of Christendom. But we have the Old Testament dispensation. The church age started in 30 A.D., and Zechariah has already given us detailed prophecies about the coming scattering of the Jews throughout the world. That would occur in 70 A.D. when three Roman legions came in and knocked down the walls around Jerusalem, knocked down the temple, destroyed it, killed 1 million Jews, and sold off the rest of them into slavery. We studied last time the prophecy in Luke that was written about 63 A.D., and the Lord Christ said, "When you see armies surrounding Jerusalem, to the believers, get out. Flee Jerusalem immediately." And the Christian Jews that did that in 66, 67, 68, 69 A.D., they survived. They lived. And this is historically a fact. And the early church fathers and other historians record that the Jews that were believers, that knew Bible doctrine, they listened and they left. And also we're going to see that Zechariah is going to again talk about this other period of another great war where all nations will be gathered together against Jerusalem to destroy Jerusalem, all nations in the world, and that will occur right here before the second coming. The Jews will be back in their land. They will have a national entity. There will be a temple that's rebuilt during the tribulational period. And all nations of the world will be gathered together to attack the Jews in Jerusalem. And that's where we resume our study in chapter 13. But we probably want to note again, just to inculcate, that Zechariah 12:10 is an amazing prophecy about this last event. Because it says right after the Lord goes out and makes battle against all nations of the world, and right after the second coming occurs, where believing Jews go into the millennium. So all Jews that are alive at the end of the great battle and at the second coming, they will go into the millennium. They'll go in with their old sin nature. And all Gentiles that are alive, they'll go into the millennium in their old sin nature. Now remember, when Christ comes back at the second coming, mature believers and all believers will be coming with Christ. And mature believers will be ruling with Christ for 1,000 years. They'll be ruling cities, states, provinces. They'll be acting as judges. And they will be ruling with Christ for 1,000 years in their resurrection bodies. Not all believers, but the mature believers will be ruling with Christ during the millennium. And these believers will include people in the Old Testament and in the New Testament. They'll be ruling with Christ. And, of course, what will be the attitude of the Jews that are believers that go into the millennium? Well, we studied that on Sunday with Zechariah 12:10, where it says, "I will pour out on the house of David and on the inhabitants of Jerusalem." So that's the entire area, because the land covenant that was promised by God to the Jews will be fulfilled at that time. And the Jewish state will cover vast areas of what today we call the Middle East, cover large portions of Egypt, all of Lebanon, all of Jordan, all the way up into Syria. It'll cover a huge amount of territory that's never been fulfilled in the history of the Jews. Even under King David, they didn't conquer lands that were promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But that will happen. And also, the Spirit of grace will be poured out, "And they will look on me whom they have pierced." Obviously, this is the Messiah. He was pierced in his hands, in his feet, on the cross. "And they will mourn for him as one mourns for an only son, and they will weep bitterly over him like the bitter weeping over a firstborn." So the Jews that are believers will have national mourning. And we noted last time that each family will mourn to themselves, which means, of course, everybody's responsible for their own spiritual growth and their own behavior. No one can save you because you're in a family or you're associated with someone. You have to make your own decisions. So in chapter 13, we go back to, in the Hebrew writing style, again, you've got to understand Hebrew writing style. They don't write like we do. They don't think like we do and our writers think. Usually we're very much in terms of chronology. When you write something, it's A, B, C, D, 1, 2, 3, 4. And then you might expand on 4 and then go on to 5, 6, 7. What the Hebrews would do, they'd give a general outline and then they'd go back and fill in details, and then sometimes they would contrast areas of blessing with areas of cursing. And so you have to understand Hebrew writing style, and Hebrew writing style is for thinkers. because you've got to understand what's going on, and it requires thought. And of course, everything that's worthwhile requires thought. And it's unlike the system that we have today in the way that we think in the Western world. So when you read Isaiah, you read Zechariah, you go, that doesn't make any sense. I can't follow it. That's not the way they write. The Hebrews don't write that way. They write in a style that, again, gives you a summary and then fills in. They go back and fill in details. Or they talk about contrast of periods of blessing with periods of cursing. And, of course, periods of blessing and periods of cursing occurred in the day of Zechariah because they were just coming back off of 70 years of divine discipline. It occurs here. And Zechariah also talked about the revolt of the Maccabees. And then, of course, he also is talking about here. You get periods of blessing and cursing. So let's start in 13 with that understanding. In that day, a fountain will be opened for the house of David and for the inhabitants of Jerusalem for sin and impurity. In that day, again, that phrase, in that day, that we've seen the last couple of chapters, always refers to either events during the tribulation, at the second coming, or during the millennium. It's always the future events, the end of the world, as we would say in our English thought pattern. So in that day, now this is after the second coming has occurred. In that day, a fountain will be opened for the house of David and for the inhabitants of Jerusalem for sin and impurity. The fountain will be opened obviously refers to salvation in the millennium. Because in the millennium, again, humans go into the millennium. At the second coming, all demons are cast off the earth. Satan is chained for 1,000 years in the abyss. All unbelievers are taken off the earth. This is called the baptism of fire. And the only people that go into the millennium, which is perfect environment, there'll be no more war, there'll be no more poverty, there'll be no more of the issues of disease. People will live for 1,000 years. There'll be no more death. The only death that will come about, apparently, is by crime or by the administration of capital punishment by the government. But you're not going to die from disease. You're not going to have cancer. You're not going to have any of the other problems. You will not grow old in that sense. And so when people go in the millennium, they will go in, though, with their what? Their old sin nature. So there will be the influence of the old sin nature. There'll be no influence of demons, because all demons are cast off. There'll be no influence of the old religious systems, the great whore of Babylon during the tribulation. Satan's chained up. So the only negative in the environment is the old sin nature. So in that day, a fountain will be opened for the house of David and the inhabitants of Jerusalem. And again, this is the concept of water, the concept of drinking, and our categories of Bible doctrines, which we will get out soon. We have those categories. We've studied this before. How are you saved? Well, you're saved the same way that these people are going to be saved. They believe in the Messiah. They believe in the Messiah and they're saved. One speck of faith more than none at all. For sin and impurity. Sin is, again, there's going to be people that are born. And sin will occur because the sin nature is active. And so when people are born, they're going to need to get the gospel. Because the original parents that go in the millennium, they're not going to die, but they're going to have a lot of kids. Because the family unit is still active. The divine institutions are still active. You have governments, you have families, you have economy, you have nation states. All the divine institutions that we are familiar with right now will be taken into the millennium because you have to maintain order and stability in society. And impurity, of course, is rebound because you're going to need to rebound. And the rituals in the Old Testament dispensation will be reinstituted during the millennium. And these rituals, of course, because this is not the church age. The church age is gone. This is a special dispensation. It is not the church age. And therefore, their spirituality is not based on our system of spirituality. They're not royal family. They're closely associated with the Old Testament believers. And so as we read on, it says, so you're going to have, the gospel is going to have to be given to new humans that are born. And guess what? A lot of the new humans that are born will say no to the gospel. Because perfect environment does not solve the problem. And this is a demonstration. I'm going to give you 1,000 years of perfect environment. Will it solve the problem of the old sin nature? No, not at all. It doesn't solve the problem of the church age. It didn't solve the problem of the Old Testament. It didn't solve the problem in the Garden of Eden. Perfect environment is not the answer. Social justice is not the answer. And serving the common good is not the answer. It's whitewashing the devil's world. But here, it's not the devil's world. It's the world of flawed beings in perfect environment. Verse 2, it will come about in that day, declares the Lord of hosts. The Lord of hosts means Lord of the armies. That I will cut off the names of the idols from the land, and they will no longer be remembered. And I will also remove the prophets and the unclean spirit from the land. All the false prophets, all the old system of religion, all the demons will be kicked off the earth. So they're going to start out with a perfect environment. They're not going to be influenced by any religious systems. They're not going to have any demons to stir up the pot. None of these things are going to be active at all. And verse 3, and if anyone still prophesies, now this is a if, which is a first class, a third class condition. Some will. Some people in the millennium will start a new religion. A new religion. And it comes out of the lust pattern of the old sin nature. And that's where it comes from. They're not getting the old books. They're not getting, you know, the religion of Islam or the religion of Buddhism or Hinduism. That's all wiped out. But they start their own new religion. Because the lust pattern of the sin nature, they want to, and you know what religion is, it's works. I want to impress you, God, with my vegetable garden. Cain and Abel, same old song. I'm going to do something. So, if you reject the gospel, obviously you've got to fill up the vacuum in your soul with something. And they fill it up with the same old fig leaves that Adam and Eve, your grandparents, did when they sinned. Same old, same old. So, if anyone still prophesies, then his father and mother who gave birth to him will say to him, you shall not live, for you have spoken falsely in the name of the Lord. So, they're saying that this is really the name of the Lord. This is the new religion. And I'm going to tell you all about the new religion. We'll see what the new religion is in a second, these subsequent verses. But this is the general principle. So the general principle is, remember, Hebrew style, somebody is falsely advocating a new way of salvation. And, of course, the mother and the father basically are going to be given the privilege of executing their own kids that get involved in this new religion. You shall not live, for you have spoken falsely in the name of the Lord. And his father and mother, who gave birth to him, will pierce him through when he prophesies. So they will carry out the death penalty. But, of course, under jurisprudence, they have to have a trial first. The parents aren't just going to kill them. But if the parents know that they're involved in this stuff, they're going to be given the privilege to carry out the death sentence. Who issues the death sentence? Well, you do. If you're one of those mature believers in a resurrection body that's ruling in the millennium, you will hear the case, and you'll issue the death sentence. Verse 4, and it will come about in that day that the prophets will each be ashamed. Now, these are the people involved in this new false religious system. Will each be ashamed of his vision when he prophesies, and they will not put on a hairy robe in order to deceive. So now we have another clue of what this false religion is about. A hairy robe. Well, that's when you take, John the Baptist had one of these hairy robes. They're very rough skin, and instead of softening up the skin, and what they would do in the ancient world, there's various ways to soften the hides, they turn the robe inside out so it would itch your body. It would not be very comfortable to wear. And you would say, well, why would you do that? Because you're religious. You want to show that you're suffering for God. That's what they want to do. It's works. And, of course, we have the same thing today. I'm starving myself for God. I'm not wearing a bright pink dress because it's unholy. I'm going to wear the ugly gray one. Of course, I think gray is a great color. The ugly purple one. So you're doing something for God. You've seen these people. They don't wear makeup because it's unholy, and they're going to walk from this city to that city, or they're going to crawl on their hands and knees and eat turnips and Brussels sprouts to show God how great they are and how much they're suffering, whatever it is. It comes in a variety of forms. You're working for God is basically the whole thing. You're in a jet airplane. You want to get out and push. God has never needed your help or my help to do anything for salvation, for keeping us saved, or for advancing the Christian way of life. But that's what these idiots do, the same thing that the idiots have always done. We're going to put on the camel hair, goat skins, or whatever, upside down, so we can suffer for Jesus in order to deceive. It's a lie. Verse 5, but he will say, now this is at the trial. So at the trial, they're going to be at the trial, and this is what their defense is going to be. Because when they come before the judge, they got to say something. Because you've been accused of being engaged in this new false religious system. And he will say, I am not a prophet. In other words, I'm not one of these false religious system guys. I'm a tiller of the ground. Everybody knows me in this community. You know I'm a farmer over here. That's what I do. I till the ground. I make strawberries. I'm not one of these nuts. For a man sold me as a slave in my youth. This simply is an idiom to mean that everybody in this community has known me from my youth. Because when you have a slave sold, everybody you keep track of your money. Everybody in the community knows me. That's an idiom. Verse 6, and one will say to him, so one, this is the judge, and the judge will say to him, what are these wounds between your arms? Now, in the old days, what some of the cults would do is they would cut themselves. If you remember the story of Elijah and the prophets of Baal, the prophets of Baal were trying to bring fire down to ignite their sacrifice to the god Baal. And they would cut themselves. They'd take knives and cut themselves, and blood would flow out. They'd collect the blood, trying to get the god's attention. And, of course, Elijah, in his humor, said, well, maybe the gods are asleep right now. Why don't you scream a little louder and cut more blood out of yourself? Or maybe they're having sex, because that's what he said in the Hebrew, because that's what the gods did. They partied a lot. And, of course, that's what they did. They're trying to impress God, so you take a knife and you cut yourself. And now, the Jews had this custom, too. When you have great frustration, they would rip their garments. They'd take their clothes and tear them, and rip their garments. They'd throw ashes on their hair and cut their hair and do different things. So, in and of itself, it's not bad to have emotion, but these people, that's what they did. So, they would say, and one will say to him, this is the judge, what are these wounds between your arms? Then he will say, here's the response, those with which I was wounded in the house of my friends. It's not the house of my friends. If you have a Hebrew lexicon, you'll see it's a whorehouse. So he's saying, I got these wounds from my lover who was scratching my back in sex, and that's how I got it, or my arms, or whatever it is. Because what they're saying is that I know I won't be executed for having, you know, going to a house of prostitution, but I know I'll be executed if I'm involved in this religious system. So therefore, that's my excuse. I had rough sex with my lover in the house of prostitution. Don't you love it how these people are bold and they tell you right what it says in the Hebrew? No, they don't tell you, because these prudes that write this stuff, the house of my friends. What does that mean? It means nothing. But it's a house of prostitution is what it says in the Hebrew. So, So that's going to be his defense. And of course, if he's found guilty, so these filled in the details. We go back to verse 1 and 2. Then the parents will be given the privilege to execute their own child. And the parents, of course, are believers, because the parents go into the millennium as believers. And if they don't want to carry out the sentence, of course, somebody else will be there to carry out the sentence. So the point is that Zechariah is prophesying that all is not well in River City. That there's going to be the sin nature in the millennium, and you're going to have these people that reject the fountain of water, reject the gospel, and turn into this religious system that's manifested itself in works and rituals, and they're going to say it's from God. We're prophesizing God told us to put on the hairy robes and cut ourselves. No, he doesn't. Not at all. So they're rejecting it, and they think it up all by themselves, because Satan's not there to stir things up like he was for your grandparents in the Garden of Eden. They just do it all by themselves. The lust pattern of the old sin nature. Now, your grandparents, and my grandparents as well, they didn't have a sin nature. But these people that go in the millennium, they will have the sin nature. So the only way you can die in the millennium, this is one of the ways you can die, capital punishment. And will murder take place in the millennium? Yeah. And if you're caught, it says in other passages about the millennium that Christ will rule with an iron rod, which means capital punishment. You will be executed for a variety of things if you step out of line. And of course, we noted in Revelation at the end of the millennium that Satan is released from the abyss right here. And he gets all these folks that are dissatisfied with God, stirs them up, and they march on Jerusalem to destroy God. And then, of course, that's called the Gog and Magog Revolution. So that tells you a lot of people are going to be born, because 1,000 years of having sex, you're going to have a lot of kids. And the bodies won't wear out, and so there'll be a lot of people on the earth. And many people will reject the gospel, reject Jesus Christ. And that's the way it always is. There's always a great division when free will is operational. Now, verse 7. So, in the Hebrew style, we're now going into another topic. Awake, O sword, against my shepherd. The sword, again, the Bible endorses capital punishment. We studied this before as a specific doctrine. I quote Romans chapter 13, verse 4, where it says, God says, I set these people up and they don't hold the sword in vain. If you're a Christian, you commit a murder, don't say, I'm a Christian, I deserve a break. You should, you're going to be executed. Now, you're going to go to heaven, but you will be executed. And of course, it's funny how people get religion in jail. But again, why do so many people get religion in jail? Because there are some genuine Bible ministries in jail. Because suffering always orients people to reality. And it's great suffering in prison. And so many people do turn to those things, but some of them get sucked in to false religion. And of course, that occurs. But it's all based on their free will. So, awake, O sword, capital punishment, against my shepherd. Who is my shepherd in caps? Jesus Christ is the shepherd. He's a lamb that takes away the sins of the world. And against the man, my associate. Now, my associate here is a word that recognizes the deity of Christ. Who is an associate with God? Well, God, my equal. So on the one hand, it's my shepherd, which is the hypostatic union, and against the man, my associate. So he's man, he's true man, and he's true deity. That's the hypostatic union right here spoken of by the prophet Zechariah, declares the Lord of hosts. Now in this case, the Lord of hosts is a term for God, but you always got to figure out what member of the Trinity are they talking about. Well, this is God the Father. In this case, God the Father is also the Lord of the armies. And the armies, of course, refers to the angelic beings. And then it says, strike the shepherd, that the sheep may be scattered. Christ actually used this prediction in Matthew 26:31. The shepherd is struck. Christ, O sword, is capital punishment. Christ suffered capital punishment for us. He took our place. We deserve to die. We deserve to be executed for our sins. And he took the execution sentence in his own body on the tree. So strike the shepherd, capital punishment, that the sheep may be scattered. And of course, this is a prediction when Christ said, when the shepherd is struck, the sheep will scatter. And the sheep was referring to his 11 disciples. They all scattered like quail. Bo, have you ever seen quail? They'll just go everywhere. Off. John came back. He was the only one at the site of the crucifixion. But initially, John scattered like all the rest of them. And Christ predicted that this would happen. This refers to when he is struck, that all the people that said, I'll never desert you, Peter, they'll never take you, Lord, I will never, all these other knuckleheads will run, but I'll never run. Peter denied him three times. Not only ran, but he denied him with a curse. Three times. And so emotion doesn't mean anything. So when you say, I'll never do this, I'll never do that, that's speaking in the energy of the flesh. What God is impressed with is God. And that is looking into our souls and seeing that we reflect the mind of Christ. That impresses God. And then when you use that, because we study in Hebrews chapter 11, you must believe that God will reward you. And He will reward you. If you don't believe that He will reward you by keeping His word, then you will not get rewarded. If you demand a lot of grace, you'll get a lot of grace. If you demand a little grace, all shucks, I don't deserve it. You think? Of course you don't deserve it. Don't give me this all shucks, this phony baloney, that you're so humble. I demand grace. I want it all. And that should be all of your attitudes. That, yeah, I want it. So if you put restrictions on grace, then you'll get a little bit out. If you put no restrictions on it, it says, yes, I believe it. And you say that you will do this, and I believe that you will do it. I'm going through suffering, but I know at the end of the tunnel, you will provide what you think you want. And I just need to wait on the Lord and claim those promises. That's called the faith rest technique, which is one of the problem-solving devices in 1 Corinthians chapter 13. Three problem-solving devices are listed. Faith, which is the faith rest technique. You hear a promise of God, you claim the promise, and you rely on it. Faith, hope, elpis. Faith is, of course, pistis, elpis, and agape. Elpis is hope. There's three categories of hope. Hope one, I have absolute confidence that I am saved. And you should be able to come to that point when you start taking in Bible doctrine. When someone asks you if you're saved, you say, you're damn right I'm saved. That's when you have ultimate confidence. And that gives you, that's a problem-solving device because you know you can't lose your salvation. It's relaxing. So when you screw up, you don't say, oh my God, I lost my salvation. No, you don't. You say, I screwed up. Now I will click in and use the rebound technique. 1 John 1:9. And God, that's grace also. You're saved by grace, you live by grace. Hope 2 is the hope that says, when I learn enough Bible doctrine, I will advance from a baby to a mature believer. And you will get there. And then hope 3 is, when I stand in my resurrection body, I will be heavily decorated, which will glorify God. And when you get to the hope 3 category in life, you will notice that you will get the big test, which will force you to pinpoint your brain from the earth up into eternity, up into the third heaven. You're concentrating on that. And that's a problem-solving device as well. And then the third problem-solving device in 1 Corinthians chapter 13 is the best, is the greatest. That's called agape, which is impersonal love, unconditional love. What does that mean? That means I is the subject, love is the transitive verb, and you is the object. I love you. All the emphasis is on the subject. If somebody hates you, you don't hate back. They lie about you, you don't lie back. They're mean to you, you're not mean back. Because the first tendency from the old sin nature, someone's mean to me, I'll be mean to them. If they hurt me, I just won't give them my attention anymore. I'm going to go pout in a corner because they hurt me. Well, poor little you. You know, you're going to go have a pity party all by yourself. Well, just turn the microscope on you, because relative to God, we should all be a cinder of ashes on the ground. So when you start feeling sorry for yourself, or you start feeling this or feeling that, you're not using agape love, because that's a wonderful problem-solving device. Because you concentrate on God, you don't get your eyes on people, you get your eyes on God, you live your life in the light of eternity. You're here for a very short time, very short time. And if you're in your 20s or 30s, oh, I got a long time, maybe you do, maybe you don't. You don't know how long you've got. It could be the thin silver cord could be cut at any time. But even if it is a long time, it's not a long time. That's a very short period of time. So agape love orients you to reality. And it's not a newsflash that people are no damn good. If it's a newsflash to you now, then let me break the news to you. People are no damn good, including yourself. That's just the way it is. If they don't do it, they think it. Don't raise your hand. We'll all be raising our hands together and have a holy roller session here. That's basically it. They're no damn good. So don't get shocked when the no damn good hits you, because you're no damn good either. And what you think has been done to you, you've done to other people as well. And God can play back the tape many, many times and show that you did the same thing. But that's the hypersensitive person, the arrogant person. God makes war against the arrogant, but he gives greater grace to the humble. The humble are those that realize that they're no damn good and they rely on the grace of God. The arrogant person, they're hypersensitive about themselves. Everything that happens is around them. It revolves around them. The grace-oriented person is not hypersensitive about themselves at all. And the arrogant person is insensitive to others and hypersensitive about themselves. So agape love is the only command we're commanded to do. We said this in 1 John. You can't do that unless you're a mature believer. You can't do it. Impossible. You can't perform the commandment to love the brethren unless you're a mature believer, because the brethren suck. And you just can't do it unless you have a lot of Bible doctrine in your soul. And you have to understand that concept that, okay, I'm going to forgive as Christ forgave. What does that mean? Christ didn't hold any grudges against anybody. He died on the cross for sins. He knows that we're all going to fail in the future. And I will make a prediction right now, even though I don't have the gift of prophecy, but I will predict that all of us are going to fall on our faces in the next year. I'll just give you a year. And it's going to happen. And then what are you going to do when you fall on your face? Well, if you have Bible doctrine, you get up, you dust yourself off, rebound, and keep moving. Keep moving, keep moving, keep moving. The testimony of every Christian at one time or the other is going to be, I screwed up, I left Bible doctrine, and I came back. Praise the Lord. That will be your testimony. That will be the testimony of everybody. Because we have the old sin nature, and we will screw up. So, we're back to Zechariah 13:7. Awake, O sword, against my shepherd, and against the man, my associate, declares the Lord of hosts. Strike the shepherd, and the sheep may be scattered, that the sheep may be scattered. And I will turn my hand against the little ones. Actually, it doesn't say I will turn my hand against the little ones. It says I will put the little ones in my hand, not turn my hand against them. He's going to protect the little ones. The little ones are always the believers. God doesn't turn his hand against believers that are positive. He provides for believers that are positive. So it's not the turn my hand, if you have the New American Standard Version. I will protect with my hand the little ones. And the little ones are the believers. The believers will always be protected. The most positive force in the world is human positive volition. And God respects that and protects it. Verse 8. It will come about in all the land, declares the Lord. Now he's going back. This is the blessing part. The Messiah is going to die. And now we're going in Hebrew style. We're going back to the great battle. The great battle that's going to occur before the second coming. And that's just Hebrew style. You got to follow the ball. So now we're taking off this theme of the fact that Christ is going to die for the sins of the world. And we're going back to the battle. It will come about in all the land, declares the Lord, that two parts in it will be cut off and perish. So of the belief of the Jews in Jerusalem, when these four nations come together for the last great battle of Armageddon, two-thirds of the Jews are going to die. They're going to be cut off. These are the unbelieving Jews. Because the little ones, which is our connection here, are going to be protected. God will not turn his hand against the little ones. He will protect the little ones, which are the believing Jews. So that tells you that one-third of Jews alive in the land right before the second coming are going to be believers. Two-thirds are unbelievers. But the third will be left in it. And I will bring the third part through the fire. That's the baptism of fire. They will go into the millennium. These believing Jews will form the nucleus of the new Jewish nation in the millennium. Two-thirds will be wiped out. Either they'll be killed in the battle or the Lord will take them off with the baptism of fire. We studied the seven baptisms before, and the baptism of fire is one of those seven baptisms. The word baptism, baptismo, means to identify one thing with something else. And this has nothing to do with water. There's no water in this particular baptism of fire. It is simply the fire means they will be taken off the earth. Refine them as silver is refined and test them as gold is tested. All believers get testing for growth. That's how you grow. That's how you develop. And they will call on my name and I will answer them. I will say, they are my people. These are the believing Jews, the one-third. Because they're going to be screaming out to God as these four armies come up. We saw the Bible class before last that the Elephs, the two general officers that are Jews, will fight. They'll get these one-third Jews together and get whoever can hold a gun and they're going to fight against these overwhelming odds. And of course, we also saw that God will cause the flesh to rot off these invading armies. He will cause mass confusion in their forces, and he'll also allow these Jews to go out and participate in the fighting. And the Lord is my God. Chapter 14. Behold, a day is coming for the Lord when the spoil taken from you will be divided among you. Now, once all these people are dead at the second coming, the Jews that remain in the new kingdom, they're going to collect up all the booty, all the gold, etc., etc., and also they have to bury all the dead. And the burial of the dead is covered in Revelation and other passages where it says it takes them months to bury all the dead bodies. So there's going to be a lot of burial details out there, but they're also going to get all the spoils that are from these other nations. And I will gather all the nations against Jerusalem to battle. Now we're going back to before the battle occurs, and that's how the Hebrews write. We're getting more details about this battle. For I will gather all the nations against Jerusalem, all the nations in the world, the king of the north, the king of the south, the king of the east, and the king of the west. We studied this in Revelation, against Jerusalem to battle. And the city will be captured. So it gives us details. When these four converging armies come in, they will capture the city of Jerusalem. And the houses will be plundered. So the armies start moving through the city, and they'll start plundering houses. The women ravaged, that means raped, which occurs anytime you have battle and armies are unrestrained. Women are always raped. All the women are raped. In Berlin, when the Russians came into Berlin, every female was raped repeatedly by the Russians because the generals just turned the Mongols loose on the German population. And half the city exiled, but the rest of the people will not be cut off from the city. So half the city is going to be taken. This has never occurred in history. This will occur in the last great battle. It hasn't occurred yet. But the army is going to stop to rape and pillage. That's why they don't sweep up the entire city at once, because that kind of takes them off the mission of going from house to house, because they're going to stop at house to house and engage in these activities. Then the Lord will go forth and fight against those nations as when he fights on the day of battle. So at this point, when half the city is taken, that's when the second coming is going to occur, right at that time, when all is lost. In that day, his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives. On the Mount of Olives is exactly where Christ went up. In the book of Acts, in chapter 1, the disciples were looking up when Christ ascended. Remember, he stayed on the earth, and he ascended up, in Acts chapter 1, verses 9 to 12, because an angel said, exactly the same spot where he went up, he will come back. And that's the Mount of Olives. And his foot will touch the Mount of Olives when he comes back, the second coming. This is not the rapture. At the rapture, Christ does not come back to the earth. The rapture is when all church-age believers are taken off the earth. It occurs right before the tribulation. And we studied this in 2 Thessalonians and 1 Thessalonians as well, when it says, we who are alive, which are the believers in the church age that are alive, will be caught up together with those that are dead, will meet Christ in the air, and so shall we ever be with the Lord. And church age believers, during that 7-year period of tribulation on the earth, that's when the judgment seat of Christ will occur, where you will get your reward, you'll be evaluated. And then you will come back with Christ at the second coming. We'll be the bride of Christ. So, back to the study here. In that day, his feet, in that day, again, it always refers to this end time. His feet will stand on the Mount of Olives, which is in front of Jerusalem, on the east, and the Mount of Olives will be split in the middle from east to west by a very large valley, so that half the mountain will move toward the north and the other half towards the south. There'll be a gigantic earthquake that will occur. In fact, there's been a study by seismologists that there's a gigantic fault line running right underneath the Mount of Olives, just waiting to be cracked. And when the Lord's toe touches that area, it will split into a gigantic valley. As we'll see later, it'll become a waterway. And it will connect the water from the Dead Sea, the Red Sea, Dead Sea, all the way to the Mediterranean. And Jerusalem will now be a port city in the millennium. Verse 5, you will flee by the valley of my mountains, for the valley of my mountains, of the mountains, will reach to Azel. Yes, you will flee just as you fled before the earthquake in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah. Then the Lord my God will come, and the holy ones with him. So, this is the escape route. The one-third believe that, well, the one-third believing Jews, and whoever Jews are in Jerusalem at the time fighting, that's where they will escape. They're in their last stand, the barricades are up, the Mount of Olives will split, and just like when Moses was at the Red Sea, and the sea opened up, and the Jews went out, the Jews will flee through this valley. It's like a back door right out of the city. And immediately, coterminous with that event, the Lord my God will come, and all the holy ones with him. That's all believers. That's you. All church-age believers will come with the Lord Jesus Christ at the second coming. They will not all rule in the millennium. Only mature believers will rule in the millennium. In that day, there will be no light. Now again, we're going back to just before the second coming. So you see how the Hebrew style goes. Bing, 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 bing. Back and forth like a tennis game. In that day, there will be no light. The luminaries will dwindle, for it will be a unique day which is known to the Lord. Neither day nor light, but it will come about that at evening time there will be light. That tells you when the second coming will occur. Now, I've got in your notes that there's this idea of supernatural darkness is covered throughout the Old Testament. It's covered throughout the Old Testament. Zechariah talks about it. Isaiah talks about it. It's also in Joel, where it just says, all the stars will be blackened. All the sun will not give us light. We studied that. I think I quoted those verses in the last Bible class. And why is that? Well, the armies that are coming in to converge, when there's no light, they can't move anymore. Their movement is limited. And so there'll be no light. Total supernatural darkness on the face of the earth. But at evening time, there will be light. What's that light? That's Christ. When Christ comes back, fantastic light. So it tells us that when you reckon when will Christ come, when the second coming occur, it'll be in what would normally be called evening time. But of course, there'll be no light, so you won't know it's day or night. But if you have your stopwatch, you'll say, okay, it's 6 o'clock at night, still dark. Christ will come in the evening time, the second coming. There will be light. That's the light of Christ coming back. And that day, living waters will flow out of Jerusalem. Now, we're going back to the millennium now. In that day, after the slaughter occurs and the millennium starts, in that day, living waters will flow out of Jerusalem, half of them towards the eastern sea and the other half towards the western sea. It will be in summer as well as in winter. The water will flow through this gigantic valley that's created from the Mount of Olives. God will be the king over all. 9. And the Lord will be king over all the earth in that day. The Lord will be the only one. And his name, the only one, Jesus Christ, will rule for 1,000 years from his capital city of Jerusalem. All the land will be changed into a plain from Geba to Ramon, south of Jerusalem. But Jerusalem will rise and remain on its site from Benjamin's gate as far as the place of the first gate to the corner gate and from the tower of Hananel to the king's wine presses. So the city of Jerusalem itself, and this is mapped out exactly how big it's going to be, is going to be sitting up on a hill, but the areas surrounding it are going to be in a plain. Now right now, if you go to Israel, you'll notice it is a very mountainous region. There's mountains and valleys and gullies and all stuff all over the place. So the Lord's going to smooth that stuff out in his perfect environment. 11. People will live in it. So people, Jews, will live in Jerusalem. They're going to go into the millennium with their old sin nature. And there will no longer be a curse, for Jerusalem will dwell in security. They don't have to worry about anything. There's no cursing. There's no cycles of divine discipline for the Jews. For 1,000 years, Christ will rule there. Verse 12. Now this will be the plague which the Lord will strike all the peoples who have gone to war against Jerusalem. Now we're going back to right before the second coming, when these four armies are surrounding Jerusalem. So you see the Hebrew style? You're going in, going out, going in, going out. It requires thought. It requires thought. And it's very exciting because the writer's taking you from the good news to the bad news. The good news to the bad news. So, verse 12. Now this will be the plague with which the Lord will strike all the peoples who have gone to war against Jerusalem. And again, this is filling in the details from Zechariah 14, verses 1 to 3, which gives you the general summary. The Lord's going to fight. Half the city's going to be plundered, etc., etc. And then right at that exciting moment, here's what the Lord's going to do to the armies. Verse 12 really amplifies verses 1 to 3 in chapter 14. Now this will be the plague which the Lord will strike all the peoples who have gone to war against Jerusalem. Their flesh will rot while they stand on their feet, and their eyes will rot in their sockets, and their tongue will rot in their mouth. Sounds like kind of biological warfare, whatever it is. They're just going to get zapped. Verse 13, it will come about in that day that a great panic from the Lord will fall on them, and they will seize one another's hand, and the hand of one will be lifted against the hand of another. When there's this supernatural darkness that's occurring, there's going to be great panic. And people will start killing each other. And nothing worse in a military, in an army, than panic sets in. When you get panic setting in, it's all over. I don't care how big the army is. There's a wonderful story about the first battle of Manassas during the war between the states, when the Federals were driven off the field back towards D.C. And the entire Federal army just started to run. They threw down their guns and started to skedaddle as fast as they could. Even though they outnumbered the Confederates, they threw down things and they ran as fast as they could. There was a Union officer on his horse, and he was trying to stop the panic. And he's told one man that was running by, he said, "Why are you running?" And the guy said, "Because I can't fly." And that's about what happens. When armies panic, they forget everything. They throw down their weapons. Even though the Yankees had superior firepower, superior numbers, superior everything, once the panic starts, it's infectious. And they were on their way to the great run to D.C. We did the same thing to them in 2nd Manassas a couple years later. Okay, so that's what will occur in this army. Panic. 14, Judah will also fight. So we got three categories here. One is the plague that God's going to hit some of the army with. Two is the panic. And three, Judah will also fight at Jerusalem, and the wealth of all the surrounding nations will be gathered, gold and silver and garments in great abundance. So the army that we studied last time, these two general officers, these alus, the princes, they're going to be two born-again believers, Jews, that are generals in the army. They'll see these four great powers coming together to destroy the city, and they'll rally whatever troops they can find that are believers. And they'll say, get your guns, get your shotguns, get your M4s, whatever it is, and they will say, the Lord's going to fight for us. We have the book of Zechariah. We're listening to tapes that somebody left in the church age. Who knows? But they're going to figure it out. They're going to say, we have confidence in the Lord. We believe these prophecies, and we're going to fight. and they will stand and fight. Now, we studied last time that the Lord Christ told Jews, when you see armies surrounding Jerusalem, leave. So, you've got to know Scripture and when to apply it. Because if you were a Jew back here, when you saw these armies surrounding Jerusalem, you say, well, Zechariah says I should stand here and fight. You would die. If you stood and fought in 69 A.D., in 70 A.D., you were dead as a Jew. So the command then, Christ said, to flee Jerusalem. The command here, if you're a believer, don't flee, stand and fight. Because guess what? Those two-thirds that are killed, they're the ones that fled out of Jerusalem to the enemy forces. Save us, we surrender. They're all killed. So there's a time to fight, and there's a time not to fight. And you've got to know your theology. And so the good news, of course, we don't have to do the math problem because we won't be there in the tribulation. We're church-age believers. But the Jews, I'm sure some of the Jews back in 69 A.D. were reading Zechariah and said, well, it says right here, we better fight. And many of them probably read Zechariah and fled into the city and said, we're going to fight. But see, they were not rightly dividing the word of truth. Because this says, when all the nations of the world gather against Jerusalem for battle. Well, Rome is not all the nations of the world. And plus, Jesus Christ told them, as recorded in Luke in 63 A.D., when you see armies coming towards Jerusalem, flee, get out. And the believing Jews that did that were saved, and the believing Jews that didn't were slaughtered, along with the unbelieving Jews. So in this case, if you're a Jew in the tribulation, the command is to what? Flee or fight? Fight. If you're a Jew back in 69 A.D., the command is to flee or fight? Flee. So you got to know the word of God, obviously. So we've got three categories of people resisting these great armies. One, God himself, obviously, with the plague. Two, God striking fear into them. And three, God strengthening these people, as we saw last time. It said even the worst, wimpiest Jewish believer will fight like King David in that day. So you'll be doing some body counts on the kill zone. 15. So also like this plague will be the plague of the horse, the mule, the camel, the donkey, and all the cattle that will be in those camps. So the enemy camps, obviously this is written in the time, you've got to use language of accommodation. We're not going to be fighting with cows, donkeys, and goats back then, but these are the animals that carry the supplies, the arrows, the bullets, the beams. These are going to be, in today's terminology, it would be the armored personnel carriers, the tanks, the tractors, and things like that. They will simply stop. They will not operate anymore. So this plague, God's going to stop all their equipment from operating. So the command is move the tanks up, they won't move. Move the artillery up, they won't move. Nothing's going to happen. All the mechanized stuff is going to stop. 16. Then it will come about that any who are left of all the nations that went against Jerusalem will go up from year to year to worship the Lord, the King, the Lord of hosts, and to celebrate the Feast of Booths. Now we're going back to the millennium. Battle's over. All that are left. Because there's other nations that didn't, you know, a lot of people are not going to fight, and they're going to be left. And the Feast of the Booths, this is one of the Jewish feasts that celebrates the millennium. The Jewish feast, and we studied this on the Mosaic Law, really give you a chronicle of history. Because you got the Passover, and you got the Feast of the First Fruits, you got the Pentecost, which applies to the beginning of the church age, and you have a long gap. And then you have this Feast of Trumpets, which is the second coming. Then you got the Feast of the Booths. What was the Feast of the Booths? Well, Jews were told to go out of your house, put some sticks up on the ground, and put some leaves over the top, or get a tent. And you live in there, and you don't live in your normal house. That's the millennium. You'll be living under the protection of God, and you're going to be celebrating the Feast of the Booths under this concept. And so all people will be coming up to celebrate the Feast of the Booths. 17. And it will be that whichever of the families of the earth does not go up to Jerusalem to worship the King of hosts, the King, the Lord of hosts, there will be no rain on them. This is Jesus Christ. No rain means no prosperity. Remember, this is an agricultural society, and that's what that means. And this is an example, illustration. If the family of Egypt does not go up or enter, then no rain will fall on them. It will be the plague with them, with which the Lord smites the nations who do not go up to celebrate the Feast of the Booths. A lot of unbelievers will be born again. I'm not going to Jerusalem. I'm going to stay home. Well, you will not prosper as much as people that do. That's basically what it's saying. So it gives you an illustration. If you live in Egypt and do not do what you're told to do, then there's going to be consequences. 19. This will be the punishment of Egypt and the punishment of all the nations who do not go up to celebrate the Feast of the Booths. Remember, these folks are back celebrating in doing the rituals of the Old Testament dispensation. Today, you don't have to do the Feast of the Booths. Don't move out of your house and get a tent and, you know, try to celebrate the millennium. The only ritual we have is the Eucharist, but then it will be. Verse 20, in that day there will be inscribed on the bells of the horses, holy to the Lord. The bells of the horses, it's an idiom. When you had officials or people with rank would go through, they put bells on their horses and they would have little symbols and put on there to say that this is important to understand. Holy to the Lord. Holy means God's absolute justice is absolute righteousness. And the cooking pots in the Lord's house will be like the bowls before the altar. This is a idiom for prosperity, great prosperity. Verse 21, every cooking pot in Jerusalem and in Judea will be holy to the Lord of hosts. All who sacrifice will come and take of them and boil in them. All the Gentile nations around will go up to Jerusalem and worship from time to time. And these bowls are part of that process where they will share in the prosperity that is given directly to the Jews under Christ, who will rule the world from Jerusalem. So the Gentiles will be blessed by association. And there will no longer be a Canaanite in the house of the Lord of hosts in that day. A Canaanite, again, refers to those that are involved in the idol worship and the great religious systems of the day. They were idolaters, they engaged in human sacrifice, and all sorts of activities that were the antithesis of grace. Their head bowed and their eyes closed. Father, we thank you for the opportunity of studying this great book of Zechariah. We pray that you will challenge us by the contents to make them a source of blessing in our lives. In Jesus Christ's name, amen.